For Rich Cohen and millions of other fans, the 1985 Chicago Bears were more than a football team. They were the greatest football team ever, a gang of colorful nuts dancing and pounding their way to victory. They won a Super Bowl and even saved a city. Cohen was 17 years old when the Bears won their first and only Super Bowl. He was in the Superdome when they defeated the New England Patriots 46-10. In his new book, Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football, he recounts the thrilling story of their sole championship season, as well as a history of the franchise and the early NFL. It's a great pleasure to welcome Rich Cohen to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to the Superdome at such a young age to see this team?
Well, I grew up in Chicago, and I was a big sports fan, and the background was really the Chicago Cubs. I once saw a kid at a Cubs game, Chicago Cubs world champions in big letters, and then in little letters underneath it said 1908. And we were constantly being crushed by teams like the Cowboys and the Steelers. And finally, in the early 80s, Chicago started to have this great team that wasn't just a great team, had a great defense, was colorful, was weird, but also the way they played somehow, which was really to knock out other quarterbacks and terrorize other teams, was kind of like a revenge fantasy for the entire city. It was like a Sergio Leone film. And then in addition, it seemed to completely mesh with the way Chicago was, or I thought it was, the old Carl Sandburg, hog butcher to the world, Chicago. And it just was one of those times that in my whole life, it was like VE Day, man. It was like the greatest thing ever. It was, and I was given tickets to that game, and it was something like the Willy Wonka thing, getting the golden ticket, you know, getting a tour. And I got on a plane heading to New Orleans full of these drunken super fans, half of whom were arrested when we landed because of their behavior in flight. And it was just like going through into this other world where Chicago wins instead of loses every time, you know?
You point out in the book that, I mean, it's not just that they won, but how they did it is the story that you tell in the book. And it is unconventional in almost every facet.
Well, I mean, think about it. It was a weird situation. They had Mike Ditka, who'd been a great player for George Halas, who started the NFL, George Halas, who actually stripped the ball from Jim Thorpe. I mean, that's how long ago Halas played. And Ditka was the first modern tight end, and he was completely insane. I mean, Ditka got so mad after losing a poker game once, he ripped the deck of cards in half. I suggest you try to do that to get a sense of how strong somebody could be.
Right.
And he came back, and his assistant coach, his defensive coach, was Buddy Ryan. Buddy Ryan, who never made it as a player but was sort of a guru and a genius, and Ditka was not allowed to fire Buddy Ryan because George Halas wanted to keep him. So the result was you almost had these two separate teams, offense and defense. Those guys hated each other, and they slowly developed this incredible ferocity. Now, the Bears, if you know the history of the NFL, the Bears were the first team under Halas to have a modern quarterback who drops back in the pocket. His name was Sid Luckman, and it was a new position where the quarterback operates as a coach in the field. And that team, which was in the 40s, became the first modern offense, and as a result, made the quarterback so incredibly important that he became a liability. You really see it in football this year. You know, you take a team like the Packers, you knock out the quarterback, their season's over, one guy. And Buddy Ryan realized, starting really in the 60s and the 70s, that his defense didn't have to focus on people all over the field. They just had to take out the quarterback. So in Chicago, he developed a system called the 46 defense, named for a great player named Doug Plank, who is a safety, wore number 46, that basically fulfilled the playground fantasy, which is, why not have everybody rush at the quarterback? Why not try to just kill the quarterback? And then even if there's guys wide open and uncovered downfield, the quarterback will be too terrorized and too terrified to find him. And I actually interviewed for this book Danny White, who'd been a great quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. And he said playing the Bears in 1985 was the only time in his entire career where his only thought was, get rid of the ball as fast as I can. Even if I have to just throw it in the ground, as long as I'm holding it, I'm in trouble. And they went through the playoffs that year. People don't remember. They didn't give up a point in the playoffs. And you'd have games where the other team had minus 16 yards. And their defense scored more than their offense. And it was like this new force just burst on the scene that was crazy and colorful and exciting.
When you say colorful, the cast of characters that you had in that 85 team is it's incredible.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, they have,
that's central casting.
Yeah, well, first of all, you have the Super Bowl shuffle, which they actually, you know, I would say Jorge Luis Borges never won a Nobel Prize, but the Super Bowl shuffle was nominated for a Grammy. I mean, it was a gold record, gold before the team. And it was a team of guys rapping in very embarrassing old-school fashion about how they were going to win the Super Bowl. And long before they won it, courting the jinx in a big, scary way. And also, they recorded the video the morning after their only loss of the season to the Dolphins. But what it really did was it was like the theme song to the Brady Bunch in a way. It sort of trademarked or branded every player on the team and gave them this identity. And football is a sport where, think about it, I mean, the guys are in armor. You can't see their faces. It's very hard to identify with them because they're unseen. And here they were, all their personalities on display, and you had this incredible group of guys. You had Dan Hampton, the Danimal. You had Jim McMahon, who was kicked out of Brigham Young for violating the Mormon code, who showed up at his first Bears training camp carrying a case of beer. You had, you know, Walter Payton's Sweetness, maybe the greatest running back in history. You had the Fridge, who became a phenomenon that year. You had Richard Dent and Otis Wilson and Gary Fensick, who went to Yale. You had, you know, this incredible team. And four of those guys ended up going into the Hall of Fame. So not only were they really colorful and did all this stuff, but they also were great players that would have been great in any era.
You talk in the book about basically you catch lightning in the bottle, they win. And a lot of the book has to do with trying to do it again, of trying to repeat what happened.
Well, that's the thing. You sort of judge the great teams as, you know, as dynasties. That's what you want, a dynasty. You know, like the Steelers, who won so many times in the 70s and into 1980, or the 49ers, or even the Bears with the Sid Luckman Bears, which won four championships and were a dynasty. This team burned so hot, and I mean from the top to the bottom, that they almost just could not continue, if you look back on it. Key to that team was Jim McMahon. Mike Ditka's famously harsh on quarterbacks, and if you watch the games then, you could see him destroy quarterbacks' egos on live television. Quarterback's kind of like an artist. He has to ride his own self-confidence. And Ditka would crush them, and they couldn't perform. Famously, Mike Tomczak, who was a Bears quarterback then, had to seek psychiatric counseling. If you go back and watch Ditka like go after Jim Harbaugh, it's just incredible to see. But Jim McMahon just was a flake and a nut, and he didn't care. And it enabled him to sort of deal with Ditka, because Ditka would scream at him. McMahon would just give him the finger and walk away. You're watching it on TV. It was the greatest thing. And what that meant was McMahon could continue to perform. Also, Ditka called very boring plays. One of the old quarterbacks said Ditka called plays like a drunken fan. What would happen is he would call these plays, and McMahon was the only one with the guts to get to the line of scrimmage and change the play, which made the Bears very explosive. The problem is the flip side of that was that McMahon, after the Bears won the Super Bowl, goes on national TV, and a reporter says, what position should the Bears draft for? And McMahon says, owner. And that's like right there, everything good and bad about McMahon. Everybody loved it, but it meant his days were numbered, and he was traded. So one of the reasons why I think the Bears couldn't win is they without McMahon, they had no offense, and they had nobody that could stand up to Ditka. Also, I always joke that after winning the Super Bowl, every guy on that team did two things: write a book and open a bar. They basically lost all their they lost their focus. And it's like the old Rocky III thing. They lost the eye of the tiger. They all kind of sold out in one way or another. But in a weird way, as a writer and also just as a person remembering, the fact that it was one unbelievably great season flawed because it has that single loss just makes it live so much stronger in the memory. It was one group of guys, one time, the greatest ever, and then it was over.
And obviously for Chicago, as I said in the introduction, that you're looking at not only saving a team, but really also giving a city, an entire city, something to hope for, and saving the city as well.
Yeah, well, and you know, I think it's true for the whole country. But I was born in 1968. Kind of first really years aware of what was going on was the 70s, and it was just a real bad time in Chicago. You know. My dad used to tell this joke about sitting next to a guy on a plane at O'Hare Airport, and it was snowing, and it was September. And the guy said, you know, it never snowed this early when Daley was mayor. But there was always this sense when I was a kid that things were wrong, you know. And like I said, the Cubs hadn't won since 1908. The White Sox hadn't been in the World Series since the 50s. The Bears hadn't won since 63, 5 years before I was born. And everything seemed just terrible. It was just a melancholy and sad time. And then suddenly the Bears' rise seemed to rejuvenate the city. The city went completely out of its head, you know. And it was one of these things where it wasn't just people into sports. It was just everybody. And if you go around now and talk to people in Chicago who don't even care about football, mention that team, they'll just smile because it was just a great and happy time. And really, the way those guys played just expressed what the city wanted to see itself as. And after that, weirdly, this Chicago entered this kind of renaissance where it grew tremendously. It became this great, great city again that it had been like in the 1920s. And the winning of the Bears, you know, changed the mood of the city and had something about, you know, the way the city was reborn was connected to what that team did for the city. I always felt it was very important.
The name of the book is Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. The book is published by FSG. Rich Cohen, thanks very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Go Bears.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. The book published by FSG, authored by Rich Cohen. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.